From KQED Public Radio and the California Report, this is the Capital Notes podcast for Friday, December 3rd. I'm John Myers from KQED. Anthony York from the Los Angeles Times.
Yes, that sounds strange.
Is with us. For those of you who don't know, Anthony is now a corporate newspaper man.
Yep.
No longer the independent vanguard
sold out
journalist.
That's right.
But
this is the only fun I'm allowed to have anymore.
But your family operation of Capital Weekly goes on without
you. It continues, yes.
But now you are just a scribe for the LA Times.
I'm a measly scribe.
Scribe. Mm-hmm. A ink-stained wrench.
A pencil pusher.
Yeah, exactly. That's what we call you in broadcast media.
Yeah, that's right.
So we're here. Anthony, you know, we didn't know if Anthony was going to be here because he's eagerly awaiting fatherhood.
I am eagerly awaiting fatherhood.
A little podcaster making an appearance any moment.
Any moment.
Any moment.
I'll be sure to include his insightful commentary next we meet.
So if Anthony is not here in the next few weeks, one of two things has happened. The little podcaster is keeping him at home, or his new employers are telling him not to come back and opine.
In which case, I'll send a farewell note
with us in podcast
for
land.
Kevin Yamamura to read on the next
exactly
podcast.
Exactly right. Juliet, Kevin, I'll be traipsing people in to try to fill those very large,
I'm optimistic,
smart alecky shoes.
I'm optimistic that our time together will continue.
If they're listening now, remember, this is public radio, public broadcasting.
What could possibly go wrong?
All right, so we have, we don't have a lot to talk about. So maybe we should just wrap this up. See you next week, folks.
Okay.
No, but I mean, we're waiting for the big shoes to drop. The legislature returns on Monday for the new session, newly sworn in members, whole lot of freshmen in the assembly.
22, is that right?
Something like that. Yeah, I was trying to count them the other day, desperately trying to count them. Governor Schwarzenegger gives us a final budget plan of his tenure to fill the $6 billion gap in the current year. Governor-elect Brown is in parts unknown.
Right. And the fortress in the AG's office. How fitting that the Schwarzenegger administration will end with a special session called and proposals for dramatic cuts put forward, and they will be quickly ignored.
Summarily rejected.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, that's the sense we get. And that may be a slightly cavalier.
Perhaps a bit glib.
Yeah, that it's not going to be, a total take the document and not even open it. But the reality is looking at the calendar of a new governor about to take office in a matter of weeks, and then looking at what we know these proposals are going to be.
Right.
The governor's spokesman this week called them ugly cuts that's going to be full of a $6 billion hole. We think it's $6 billion. The governor's budget crunchers are going to come up with their own number on Monday. But these are not going to be choices that majority Democrats are going to embrace by any stretch of the imagination, I would assume.
And the real issue is, remember, if the Democrats send the governor an amended budget or an amended spending plan, the courts have said that the governor then has the right to go through the entire budget with his blue pencil. So even if they only sent, say, some small cuts for IHSS, I'm just grabbing
because
that
this happened in 2009, that's
right.
How we know.
And there was a lawsuit. Daryl Steinberg sued and lost. So if they send him any revised budget proposal at all, that he can then open up the entire budget and go back and blue pencil what he wants. Now, I talked to some senior budget staff yesterday, and they're trying to craft a way of perhaps sending him some things that are not an amended budget, that are very limited scope bill. But we'll see if any of that. I mean, I think there are sort of dueling political forces here. Number one is Democrats' clear distrust of Schwarzenegger and preference to deal with Jerry Brown. On the other side, I mean, you've got to imagine with a new governor coming in, even though he doesn't seem to be making this message explicit to Democrats now, the more that gets taken care of on Schwarzenegger's watch, politically, for Brown at least, the better, right? I mean, there are fewer cuts that he would have to make if the guy before him takes care of it.
But are majority Democrats in the legislature inclined to do that, to take a hit for the team, so to speak?
Well, we'll see. You know, and who knows? Who knows if it'll all be cuts? I mean, there there is some talk that some Republicans might be interested in reinstating a portion of the vehicle license fee, which is set to expire because it's earmarked specifically for law enforcement.
Well, at this point, the governor's coming out of the gate with none of that, at least according to his spokesperson on Tuesday, who said none of the temporary tax increases, of which that is called a temporary tax increase in the budget plan, the governor would support extending.
Right. Well, and so we'll see. That might be something for the new session, but we'll see.
Well, and the other part, too, though, I mean, you know, the politics, it's partly a political point, but it's a policy point. What's the hurry? And you know, the Schwarzenegger folks are going to hear me say that, and they're going to, you know, gripe about me saying that. But this is a budgetary deficit. This is not a cash management deficit.
Right.
Again, if the last few years have taught us nothing, it has taught us that there is a difference between budget deficits and cash problems
cash
that the
flow,
state has.
Right.
And that the state right now does have no cash flow problem for the next few months. We're not in danger of not paying our bills. This is a red ink problem between now and next July 1st, a very large amount of time with which to operate. I mean, theoretically large, not hugely large, in which case the need to do something immediately doesn't seem to be as pressing as it did in those years where we were faced with IOUs because we couldn't pay the bills.
Right. I mean, that's what makes this very different from 2 years ago. Remember the end of 2008, Democrats passed a majority vote budget, was vetoed by the governor. And then by February, they passed actually a budget that dealt with a 17-month solution, which quickly fell apart.
So. You know, what's interesting, though, do you know? Maybe you know this, and I haven't done enough poking around in the building to ask this question, but it would seem reasonable given the passage of Prop 25 on November 2nd. Well, actually, I guess you wouldn't need a 2/3 vote anyway.
It's all for an urgency, although it's all special session, so it's all majority vote.
Yeah. So. If you've missed the telegraphing here, folks, what Anthony and I are doing here, it's trying to determine whether you needed a 2/3 vote for these kinds of budget actions, if any were taken, given the passage of Prop 25 and all the other factors. But, as Anthony just pointed out, we're in a special session anyway, which changes the rules somewhat. And,
and
the bottom line, I think, is that that if Democrats really want to do something, they can do something. The question is, do they want to do something?
Well, they could do something, of course, if the governor would sign it.
Exactly. What remains to be seen.
Now, remember, I mean, when Schwarzenegger formally calls this special session on December 6th, one of the things it does do is it starts the 45-day clock running. Now, under Proposition 58, if the governor declares a fiscal emergency, which he will on December 6th, the legislature then – he has to submit proposals to the legislature. The legislature then has 45 days to respond. Now, Schwarzenegger will be gone on January 3rd. We'll have a new
governor. So the 45 days will not have expired by the time he's gone.
Right. But it will have begun on December 6th. And so that means that 2 weeks into Jerry Brown's tenure, that'll be the expiration of that 45 days. That means that the legislature can take up no business until the fiscal emergency is addressed. And so, as if it weren't clear enough that the budget was going to be first and foremost on the priority list and on the agenda of Governor Jerry Brown, this all but assures that essentially nothing but the budget will be happening in the first months of the Brown administration.
Yeah. And keep in mind, too, folks, with the calendar, the way this is going to work is that, the legislature comes back on the 6th. We'll see what the reaction is to the Schwarzenegger budget. Then we've got all of the holidays, which have already begun for some, for you.
Yes. Yes, Hanukkah last night. Is that what you're getting at?
Yes. I'm not Jewish, but I celebrate.
There you go.
I celebrate everything.
Well, for Schwarzenegger, I guess Hanukkah was 3 days ago, right?
That was 2 days. Yeah, exactly, when he lit the menorah early. Sorry, Friday.
Right. Because Hanukkah was inconvenient for him, apparently, so he moved it up a day.
He can do that. He's governor.
For now.
So the holidays kind of complicate things. Jerry Brown becomes governor on January 3rd with an inauguration. He will present his State of the State speech sometime that week, probably likely somewhere around midweek of that first week of January.
Is that what you're hearing?
I would assume. I'm assuming.
Is it in the first week? Does it have to be in the first week?
Let's get back. We'll get back to everyone on that one.
And then the budget.
And then the budget on January 10th.
Yes.
Which we know there's a constitutional date that we can mark on our calendar.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a very busy few weeks there. And a lot of the stuff that we don't know now, we'll know then. But it's not going to take very long to figure it out, all of that out.
Yeah.
And some of this does kind of get to another point, which is this has been a terrifically quiet transition.
Wait, do you hear that?
Oh, right.
That's the sound of the Jerry Brown transition.
That's the sound of the Brown transition team.
Yes.
Are they working? Are they? Wait, I can't. Yeah.
Huh.
Can't quite tell.
What's
yes.
the frequency, Kenneth? no, but he is working. He's in town. Well, he was in town this week.
That was a great podcast moment, by the way, where we just stopped. Go ahead.
Yeah, good. He has been seen right next door here walking out of the California Teachers Association building a couple of times this week. There have been Jerry Brown sightings.
You saw him or you have
been? I ran into Tom Quinn, one of his senior staffers outside the Department of Finance.
I was going to say maybe your moles have reported back to you, but go ahead. Yes.
No, it was the freckles.
Anyway. So long-time Brown advisor Tom Quinn,
outside the Department of Finance. And so they're around. They're working, and they're keeping a very low profile. I mean, I have been antagonizing poor Sterling Clifford, the Brown spokesman, daily, if not many times a day.
I have as well, yeah. And have received almost...
How's that working out for you?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's like sending messages out into space trying to get a transmission, and you get nothing back.
You're waiting
with those headphones, waiting.
Yeah, I even went so far as to invite the governor-elect over for latkes last night and sent Google Map directions from the AG's office to my house and... Did nothing.
Maybe he just...
And let me tell you, he missed out.
I was going to say, maybe he's just not a fan of your cooking. I mean, who knows?
It wasn't me. It was my wife, and she rocked it.
Good for her. It has been. It's been very quiet. I do think that, you know, the press always wants more access and not less. So we will... I'll stipulate that at the beginning. But I do think at a certain point, you know, that we do... That there is some question about... What is the level of engagement? You have seen him. People have seen him. We all assume he's engaged, but it's a very unusual position to be in when the problems are so big.
Right.
The campaign was so vague, quite frankly, about where he was going to lead things, other than he was going to try to figure it out. And I guess, in fact, maybe that's him fulfilling the campaign promise of trying to figure it out.
And it's not just that. I mean, some of it's style, too. Not only was the campaign vague, but the campaign was sparse. And what I think what's palpable out there to people like you and I is this sort of unease among the insider community. I mean, this is a town that thrives off access and information and
leaks and rumors
and all these things. And there's none of that. I mean, that's by design, clearly, and that's I'm sure that's a good thing for the Brown administration. It's just at some point, the press is going to get restless. I mean, I think we're already getting restless, and that's going to start seeping out into the coverage here. You know, this is the way the press smokes out the politician, right? Is by writing nasty stories about how inaccessible he is. So, I'll be looking forward to yours, and you can look forward to mine.
I think I've got to go work on that right now.
Halfway done.
You're ahead of me, man. Well, let's talk about how we got here with Brown and others, at least looking back to election stuff, because we got a couple of things that are kind of election cleanup from this week, I would call them. The first is that the election's officially over. Congratulations, everyone.
Especially Kamala Harris.
Yes. Well, but first, the votes have all been counted.
Yes.
All 58 counties, all, I don't know, somewhere around 10 million votes or so.
Give or take. What was it, 60% roughly? 60% of eligible?
Something like that, which is high. Yep. Yeah, so higher voter turnout than what is expected.
Yep.
And again, when you talk about voters being depressed or whatever, that didn't really happen, at least in that sense.
Right.
But yeah, the final piece of the puzzle was official this week. Kamala Harris is the attorney general elect, Democrat from San Francisco, beating Steve Cooley, Republican of LA, second Democratic sweep in 8 years. And the second only since the 1800s, or at least of one party sweeping all the statewide.
You know, we used to say California isn't really a blue state; it's a purple state, right? There was.
I still think it is, but you're gonna
quibble. I'm a little less certain of that now. Given the last couple. I mean, at a certain point, you got to say, "Hey, maybe." Well, I mean, this was a banner Republican year.
Yeah.
And Republicans lost. California was the only state where Democrats not only held all of their 2008 pickups in the legislature, but they picked up an additional seat. I mean, it doesn't get more out of step with the rest of the country than that.
And yet, I think that's a fair point. I mean, there's just a couple of things. I think it depends on how you define blue and red.
Democrat and Republican.
Well, fair enough, but bear with me for a moment.
Yeah.
If it's by party registration, absolutely. And I think probably just a hunch. If you look at how the gap has been widening between Republicans and Democrats in the state over the last couple of years, right? Especially since 2008, Democratic registrations ticked up. Republicans, you know, now the gap is at, what, 13 points, which is the largest it's been,
right,
you know, in almost 20 years or more than 20 years. That to me has got to account for something. I mean, just do the math. If you had, you know, turnout somewhere near 60%, Democrats were not depressed as everyone thought. I mean, that was the great miscalculation of 2010, is that Democrats wouldn't show up to the polls. So by extension, they're going to vote for Democrats, especially if they don't know a lot about them. They're going to go party affiliation. You know, we could go on what political scientists would do. So I feel like that's part of it. But I think if you look at red and blue based on issues and positions on things, I do still think we're still kind of purple.
Right.
I mean, you know, we still have the aftermath of Prop 8 that was a more decidedly socially moderate conservative position. We still have a conservative position on fiscal issues, and a lot of times look at some of the ballot measures, look at Prop 19, not exactly a raging liberal left red kind of
we may be purple, but then our Republicans are candy apple, you know. I mean, they're redder than red.
They are, and
I think that's probably part of the
problem. Yeah, and a lot of us have written that story over the last couple of weeks, which is the real demise of the California Republican Party, and I don't think you're going to find anybody who disagrees with it. Even the party faithful realize they're in a bad position. They may not characterize it in some of the harsh language that some have, but they realize they have got some serious questions to resolve about where they go forward and how they do it. And you know, and this gets back to the kind of the postmortem of the election that I don't know, maybe one day we should just do a whole postmortem here that we pre-tape or sometime for your fatherhood and something for the holidays. And we're still waiting for our cocktail podcast.
I know. Speaking of Sterling.
Speaking of Sterling Clifford, Jerry Brown spokesman, and Sarah Pompey, who work for Meg Whitman. We've got to schedule
that. Make that happen.
Yeah, whenever Sterling calls us back. By the way, Sterling, if you're listening to this, could you call me and Anthony, but call me first. But again, you know, you do wonder, back to the Harris race.
Yes.
How much of that was Harris winning? How much was Cooley losing? How much did the Whitman thing play? I mean, everybody thought that if a Republican was going to win, it was going to be Cooley. Right. Harris was not the strongest Democrat on the ticket, at least was so goes the conventional wisdom. She only won by a fraction of the votes if you really look at what the final tally is going to be in the
Cooley got more
race.
Votes than any other Republican on the ballot.
Exactly. Cooley beat Whitman and everyone else.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, but we at least got to clean up to that. And there were there were none of these things that we thought were going to happen. Congressional seats didn't turn over.
No, none of them.
One legislative seat changed hands from Republican to Democrat. So another bad news for Republicans in terms of parties. Everything else was status quo.
Yeah,
except for the governor's seat.
But again, put it in context of the national environment where Republicans took control of the House, made gains in the Senate. I mean, it was a bad year for Republicans everywhere but California, it seemed.
And it was a good year for Republicans everywhere but California.
Excuse me, yes.
That's all right. You're not quite sleep-deprived yet, but you will be soon.
I'm rehearsing.
Young father, trust me on that one. And we also have some election cleanup this week. Public Policy Institute of California put out a post-election survey which had lots of little nuggets in it that some of us have written about over the last day. But let's go back, since we're talking about the governor's race for a moment. So we know that roughly Brown won by 12 points.
Yeah, 11, 12.
Yeah, 11, 12 when the final votes are counted. So you look at this poll, which mirrors that pretty well, he won 56% of independents. Cannot win if you're a Republican and you don't win independents in California. 75% of Latinos voted for Brown.
Wow.
I mean, just a phenomenal shellacking for Meg Whitman on that one. 59% of women. The only category really that Whitman won, and I think is somewhat interesting for the long-term political future of the state, is white voters. White voters, by a narrow margin, voted for Whitman over Brown.
Right.
And that does say something, because we've talked a lot. Researchers have talked over the last few years a lot about the fact that the electorate historically has not matched up with the demographics of California. The electorate has been older, whiter, more conservative. Maybe some of that's changing. I mean, look at the Latino turnout in this race and look at what happened, the choice of white voters by a narrow margin, but nonetheless.
Right.
Didn't win the governor's race.
Well, I mean, it has to be changing because the demographics of the state are changing. I mean, we're already a plurality Latino state and will very soon be a majority Latino state. And so while that – and there's lag time certainly between between the demographic numbers and the voter registration numbers. But it's changing. I mean, it's changing. You know, older, whiter voters, there are fewer of them, certainly as a percentage of the population as a whole, and now as a population of the voting universe as a whole, because you know, Latinos now. I mean, there was a big wave of Latino immigration, the sort of second wave they call it, came in the 1980s. These were the people who many of them and their children were sort of activized politically by Proposition 187. That was already 16 years ago now, and so you have a demographic now that is, you have a generation of voters there. And as people assimilate historically, as they assimilate, adapt, stay here longer, they rise up the socioeconomic ladder, they begin voting.
And acknowledging, that's what's happening. Acknowledging the California Republican Party's problem with Latinos over the last 15 years since Prop 187, that but setting it aside for a moment, one wonders what the Latino vote would have been for Whitman versus Brown in the absence of the Republican gubernatorial primary, which Steve Poizner drove Meg Whitman way to the right on immigration, the Arizona immigration law debate that I think put Whitman again in another quandary about the issue. It was an issue that she had no interest in talking about in this race. Right. She wanted to talk about a whole set of economic issues and not immigration. One wonders, had that not happened, could she have made inroads that would have made that number different? How much of that was driven by those parts of the campaign?
Well, and the one thing you didn't mention is the Nikki Diaz issue. I mean, that's obviously a big part of it, but it dovetails with the hypocrisy issue on her immigration stand. And so, it's a problem. It's a problem. And, there was a lot, there was a very aggressive sort of sub rosa, but very aggressive Latino outreach program among Democrats. I saw 15 different mail pieces that were sent out. There was a big effort by the LA County Labor Federation and that Richie Ross led, a political consultant in town. Lots of Spanish language mail. There were ads on Spanish language TV that didn't get written about. Paid for by independent expenditure groups and it seemed to work. I mean, if those numbers are correct, that Brown won the Latino vote 3-1, it says some things about Whitman, but it also re-illustrates the systemic problems that Republicans have with Latino voters.
Especially when you ask Latino voters sometimes, and again, there's no monolithic trend where everyone who has a Latino heritage votes a certain way.
Right.
But when you ask a lot of Latino voters about the issues they care about, they do have a social conservative streak by and large that does not match up with most of the core part of the California Democratic Party. But that notwithstanding, there are issues that they obviously agree on.
Well, there's not the sort of visceral anti-government. I think there's, the polling data that I've seen about Latino voters is they believe that government can be part of the solution to people's problems, and that's
which is really almost antithetical to what the California Republican Party believes.
Extremely. And so, given those numbers that we've cited here, that sense that the government can be a force for good potentially in people's lives seems to outweigh, any strings of social conservatism that Republicans thought they would be able to capitalize in the 80s and 90s and haven't been able to yet.
Yeah. I want to make one more observation about the poll, but before that, just to close the loop on the governor's race, there was this matters only to political junkies, but if you're listening to this podcast, you're kind of like us, I guess, in some ways. This little thing here at the end of this little thing at the end of the week that a lot of us every 4 years trek down to the campus of the University of California, Berkeley, for this usually pretty interesting, if you're a political junkie, post-mortem on a governor's race. The campaigns get together and they kind of tell the truth about how the decisions came down. And political scientists go and journalists go and other people who are interested in politics is kind of a, looking back, I don't really have ever found many great stories immediately out of it. My favorite anecdote was when Bill Lockyer admitted that he voted for Schwarzenegger in the recall election after that one.
That was good.
But we found, but apparently the Whitman campaign not so interested in participating.
According
to your folks at the LA Times,
I guess not.
This.
Yes, Seema Mehta reported that this morning.
Yeah.
Guess not.
I don't know what to make of that. I mean, I don't think, you know, it's kind of like I read that and I had two thoughts. I mean, one was I was disappointed because I really would like to know how they got to where they did. You know, what happened in the primary? How did they make those decisions that got them about, and again, about Diaz? I mean, what was the conversation about whether you bring that forward, you know, versus holding on to it, hoping it doesn't leak out about the housekeeper?
Well, apparently, they didn't know.
But Whitman has said she told her campaign team after she fired her. Anyway, I digress for a moment. But the other side of me says, so what? I mean, we kind of know what happened in a lot of ways.
What's the point of being a vulture if there's no carcass to pick over? Come on. You're missing the spirit of journalism.
We want to strip those bones completely of all meat.
Hear, hear.
All right. The last thing I was going to say about the survey, again, and this is just kind of a looking forward to next year. I mean, we've been talking about government reform for a couple of years.
Uh-huh.
No one has come up with anything that really the public seems to have gotten behind. But this poll again shows, I mean, people were actually asked, do they think the initiative process needs reform? And a substantial number, I think it was somewhere over 40%, I don't have it in front of me, believe that it needs major reform.
Yeah.
And another number out of this really, to me, kind of highlighted that. Proposition 24, which was the ballot measure to rescind corporate tax breaks or business tax breaks that were part of the 2009 budget deal. Proposition 24 would have rescinded those. Proposition 24 lost at the polls on election day pretty handily. Mm-hmm. 22% of the people in this survey who voted no on Prop 24 said they have no idea why they voted no. They just voted no.
Yeah.
That's
the default. No is the default.
It is the default, but it does to me, it goes back to this issue of, you know, do the voters really have any idea what they're voting on in some instances?
Lawmakers, though?
Really. I know, but we are so dependent in California on direct democracy. And so many people say, let's keep the system, but let's fix it. And this is another example. I mean, you've got voters who just freely admit, I have no idea what I was voting on or why I was voting no. Right. Or you've got another instances they say, I thought damning for our profession was that we were way down on the list in terms of reading news stories about the ballot measures. I mean, it was the voter guide and the internet.
Yeah.
And I'm not really sure what they meant by the internet.
Well,
the
internet could be the story. I mean, a lot of people are reading them online.
But I mean, there seemed to be some real areas there for people to say, look, maybe the public now finally would be willing to consider some real changes to the system, not getting rid of the system, but not letting the system turn into what it's turned into.
Yeah, and perhaps. And, you know, there are all sorts of discussions about whether or not initiatives should have to have, say, a revenue stream, you know, attached to them before they can go to the ballot or whatever, or perhaps a higher vote threshold to qualify for the ballot. But those things, I'm sure, will come up again next year.
Yeah, yeah. We'll be back here talking about it. I'll be back here talking about it.
I think I will, too.
Okay, good. People have now breathed a collective sigh of relief.
Yeah.
I've actually had several people say, you going to do a podcast this week? Because we didn't do one last week.
Uh-oh.
We were too busy celebrating Thanksgiving.
There we were.
Well, we'll let you know whether Anthony's here next week.
Yes.
I suspect he will not be. I'm thinking the baby's.
Feeling,
I'm thinking the baby's
the baby.
On the way.
The 9th?
December 6th, actually.
Ooh.
First day of the legislature.
Great. Convenient.
Convenient.
Thanks,
for
buddy.
Your job.
Actually, it's not like I'm going to miss anything if that happens.
And on that note,
yes.
That's Anthony York from the LA Times. I'm John Myers from KQED. We'll see you next time.